Hello and welcome. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and the show you are listening to is Final Draft. Now, Final Draft is books, writing, and literary culture, bringing you interviews with Australian authors, the latest and greatest of Australian literature, discovering more about the writing that's going on in your world. 2SER broadcasts from Broadway in Sydney. It sits on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, stolen land that was never ceded. Now, it's the second week we're back for 2020 here on Final Draft, and so week two, I have got two new Australian novels for you, and not only that, two new Australian fantasy novels. I love a good sort of fantasy genre novel, and I love it even better when it's written by Australian authors. So today I am so stoked to be bringing you a new one from Alison Evans. It's a bit of a tradition. I speak to Alison at the beginning of every year. They publish books sort of in February, and it's a great way to start the year. Alison's latest is Euphoria Kids, and it looks at a magical world of three friends discovering themselves. Later on in the show, I will be bringing you Luke Arnold's debut novel. You may know Luke in his roles as an actor, but he is also a creator of stories, and his novel is The Last Smile in Sunder City, introducing you to a fantastic new world that has lost its magic. That is coming up on Final Draft today. You are on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel. Stay tuned after this short break.
Bring your ideas to life in Sydney's newest makerspace at Darling Square Library. Get hands-on in workshops to learn 3D design and printing using Tinkercad and Fusion 360, laser cutting, robotics or prototyping. Weekly Maker Time sessions offer a great intro to all equipment and tools, with starter projects and makerspace kits to try out. All workshops are led by expert makers with beginner to advanced levels available. Book now at cityofsydney.nsw.gov.au/library programs. City of Sydney sponsors 2SER.
You are on 2SER 107.3 and you're listening to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and it is with great pleasure that I'm about to introduce my next guest. Alison Evans is the award-winning author of Ida and Highway Bodies, and it has become a bit of a tradition that we start the year on Final Draft with a chat with Alison, and they are joining us today to discuss their latest book, Euphoria Kids. Welcome, Alison. It is so great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
No, look, it's wonderful, and I'm going to let people know that if they are a fan of Alison's work, well, you will know that they are a genre-bending wonder, from the dimension-hopping of Ida to the zombie horror of Highway Bodies. And today we're discussing Euphoria Kids. It is a fantasy tale of friendship and love, quite unlike anything I've experienced. You never let me down with these fantastic tales.
No, thank you.
So in Euphoria Kids, we have Iris and Babs. They go to the same school, but they don't know each other. I mean, nobody really notices Babs, not since a witch cursed her, and she periodically becomes invisible. Iris has friends, but not the human kind. They grew from a seed in the garden and have always had more kinship with the fairies and dryads that live in the bush, until one day when Babs appears to Iris on the bus. Now, I'd love, Alison, if you could start by telling us a little bit about the blossoming friendship between Iris and Babs and how friendship and connection are so magical in your story.
Well, I guess they're both very lonely, I think. And I remember feeling lonely a lot as a teenager, even though, like, I did have friends. I think it can still be a bit isolating just to be at that age. So they notice each other, and I guess they both just feel like they should be friends. And so they start to kind of learn how to be in each other's company and stuff like that. I think for queer teens, romance is kind of the narrative that people foist upon them. But I just think friendship is so important, and it was so important to me. And I just really wanted to write something that celebrates that.
Well, let's think then a little bit about this sort of coming into power and recognition, because the central tension of the novel is the reappearance in the forest of the witch who cursed Babs when Babs was young. And since she was a child, Babs has always slipped in and out of people's consciousness, and she can't control this. It's left her lonely and only living, sort of half living her life. And I wondered about how this theme of visibility relates to Iris, to Babs, and their new friend, the boy's journey to become who they are and be recognized in this very gender binary society. You just mentioned there about how it can be exciting, but also a little bit scary as you're breaking ground as a writer writing about this.
I think I'm not quite sure what I was doing with Babs's Curse because it's kind of invisibility can feel very familiar as a queer person, I think. I guess because I'm non-binary and a lot of my day, if I leave the house, is me, people not seeing me for who I am. And it's kind of, I kind of wanted to get across that feeling, but then also, like, when you are invisible, that kind of gives you a, like, a power or an advantage or, I guess, some way to control how people see you. And it can kind of give you an agency, I think.
Just following on from that, though, I was really particularly taken by, there's a chapter entitled The Story of Babs and the Heavy Day, and you take us through some of the impacts that the action of the story is having on Babs' mental health. This chapter really struck me, partly because you so rarely see a fantasy protagonist stop and check in on their mental health, but also for your depictions of the process and the support that's necessary for young people to access mental health services and actually, you know, be able to take care of their mental health. Can you talk a little bit about this chapter in the book?
Yeah, well, Euphoria Kids, I wrote it basically because I was very depressed and I wanted something that that was, like, filled with all my favourite things. So I was writing it, and during the editing process, I had to add in a couple of chapters, and I was having a pretty terrible day. And then I thought, I should write about that. And that chapter, the rest of the book is in first person, but the chapter with that's dealing with Babs' mental health is in third person. So, and for me, that's how my depression feels. Like, I don't feel quite present, I guess. And I think for a lot of the time when books are written with characters that have mental health issues, it's like an issues book, like that is the focus of the book. And I think those books are necessary, but I think it's also important to discuss mental health issues outside of that. And I guess, like, for me, it's kind of a way to, like, heal my own business. but also to let kids know that, like, you can have really wonderful friends and a really nice life and you're still depressed. And that's just a thing that happens.
Magic is so central to Euphoria Kids. And you frequently have Iris and Babs discussing whether people will understand the reality of this power. And I haven't gone too much into Iris, but Iris was born from a seed. She is sort of very much a plant, and Babs has fire inside her. And they're discussing whether people will understand that this is a reality. They're not just speaking metaphorically. Magic and its illusions, though, and its vocabulary are frequently invoked in our society metaphorically. Why was it important to emphasize that there is a distinction between the reality and the metaphor of this magic?
I'm not sure. I think I always like fiction that kind of not contradicts itself, but two things can be real at the same time. So, like, Iris and Babs are human, but, like, Iris is made of plants, Babs is made of fire, and I don't know exactly what I was trying to do. I guess I like exploring things where two things that shouldn't be real in the same universe are both real. Like, I don't know, it just adds a kind of, I don't know, like another dimension to the story.
The book is called Euphoria Kids, and there is this really touching scene between Iris and the boy as they visit a doctor. And Iris, after the visit, tells the boy about gender euphoria, about having good feelings about gender identity and it being the opposite of gender dysphoria. Can you talk a little bit? I had to look it up outside of your reference in the book to learn a little bit more, but can you talk a little bit about the concept of gender euphoria and why it is important?
Yeah, well, I started a PhD. I dropped out, but it was focused on trans people and I guess kind of the opposite of the popular perception where, you know, we're born in the wrong body and we're defined as a lack, a lack of something. And that was really damaging to me growing up, and I'm sure lots of people can relate to that. And the thing that I learned first about being trans really is gender dysphoria, and which is, for people who don't know, it's like an uncomfortable feeling about the way you present or your body or how people perceive you. And I guess, like, that's a terrible first thing to learn, I think. Like, it's so awful to experience, but gender euphoria is, like, the opposite, where you people recognize you and you feel comfortable in your own body. And I think, because the idea of gender dysphoria is so familiar to so many people, but I've had quite a few people tell me that me talking about gender euphoria is the first time they have ever heard it. And I don't know, like, I just think it's so important to celebrate being trans and, like, to let people know that it's okay to feel comfortable being who you are, because a lot of trans narratives aren't written by trans people. And I think, I don't know, I just kind of want to get the word out there that, like, it's good, being trans is good. Yeah, I think it just felt a bit like writing a bit of hope, really. I guess that's why I wrote it, because it's a hopeful book, I think.
It's a wonderful book. And once again, although, Alison, you are an adult, you have written three beautiful teen characters. And once again, it's the children reminding us how to be good adults.
Yeah, exactly. Like, whenever I meet teens at, like, writers' festivals or school visits, like, they do remind me of that. Like, I don't know. They're a hopeful bunch, which is quite... I feel very privileged to be able to write for them. Very humbling.
And on that, while there is just this incredibly rich Australian YA community, and if you want to find out more, dear listener, just search hashtag LoveOzYA in, you know, wherever you want to search for things. You probably shout it in the street and you'll find someone answering you. This is so much a book. I want to recommend this book to just everyone to read. It is Euphoria Kids. It is by Alison Evans, and they are joining me on Final Draft. Alison, thank you. Thank you so much. I love this chat. Hopefully, you know, it doesn't always have to be a year in between, but I am so much looking forward to the next book.
Thank you so much. It's always really nice chatting with you.
You are on 2SER 107.3, listening to Final Draft. Now, it is books, writing and literary culture, but I'm going to drop in a little bit of music before we come back with Luke Arnold's Last Smile in Sunder City. This is from Isabel Campbell. She used to be the cello player in Belle and Sebastian, and this is called Ant Life.
Hear it in the way we talk, see it in the way we walk.
are on 2SER 107.3 and listening to Final Draft. Now, my name is Andrew Popel, and I am very fortunate to be joined in the studio by Luke Arnold. Now, Luke's an actor, he's a director whose roles have seen him play a rock star, a pirate, as well as living in a Lazarus-like town where the dead just can't seem to stay buried. Perfect proving ground, it seems, for the creation of his debut novel, The Last Smile, in Sunder City. So, Luke, first of all, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be here.
Now, in Sunder City, Fetch Phillips, he's a man for hire, but he doesn't work for humans, and sobriety is extra. Now, this is a whole new realm for fantasy fans, and I thought maybe, start us off, can you take us on a tour of Sunder City?
Yeah, so Sunder City is set in a world that, you know, kind of has all the creatures of your typical magical land. Dragons, elves, werewolves, kind of an amalgamation of stuff from, you know, different parts of folklore. And then Sunder City is like the first metropolis of this world. So they've reached their industrial revolution. They've built a city that's kind of everyone comes together, where they're using these underground fire pits to fuel industry for the first time. And then about 6 years before our story starts, the magic dies. The humans try to tap their machines into this mystical river. It freezes. So now the elves are aging centuries and seconds. The dragons have fallen out the sky. The wizards can't do spells. And Fetch Phillips is, yeah, a man for hire on these streets. The city, for me, it's a mixture of kind of Amsterdam, New Orleans, and a few other places I've visited thrown into.
Awesome. Okay, so let's take that up. We've got this melting pot of magical folk. You've got everyone from fae to werewolves and demons. But since the coda, which is the event you talked about, there's no magic. Now, before we get to the ramifications of this cataclysm, I really want you to talk to me about that decision. So writing fantasy with all the fantastical elements bled dry, I mean, like, that's what the audience turns up for. That's kind of brave, maybe a crazy decision.
Well, look, I'm definitely not the first person in kind of all fantasy mediums to do the thing where the magic is gone. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, you know, it hasn't been done that often in specifically with those creatures we're familiar with, you know, and seeing what happens. And I guess for me, like, I, you know, over the years since, you know, kind of in high school writing the first short story ideas of this, that kind of mixed a noirish element with fantasy. I always liked those two genres. The decision to have the magic gone in this way, you know, kind of really came when I started writing this version. I think it was a little bit about, and kind of that unlocked the whole thing for me, because I'm not sure the original impetus, but for me it was a little bit like that feeling like when we're kids, the world seems magical. And then we make these choices as we grow up and do these things to fulfill our ideas of what a grown-up should be, what a man should be. And somehow it cuts us off from this, you know, that kind of splendor that we saw in the world, you know, felt connected to when we were younger. So that was a bit of the feeling. And then visually, it just lets me go crazy.
Now, Fetch, he's a gumshoe in the Dashiell Hammett Raymond Chandler mold, and his client needs him to find a vampire. So of all the dilapidated offices in all the post-apocalyptic cities in all of the world, why'd you choose Fetch?
Why did I choose Fetch as our
What does someone need to know that may about why Fetch is in this situation? He doesn't work for humans. Sobriety's extra. He's a complicated man in a complicated world. I think I've checked up a lot of cliches
as you
there.
And as do I in this first book as well. Because in a way, I feel like Fetch is the kind of guy who, you know, saw the equivalent in this world of like a Bogart movie and had an idea of masculinity. And, you know, without getting too much into his backstory, we see him kind of, I think he's always got an idea of what he should be and what the and what the right thing to do is, but he can't ever seem to do it. And I think there's something that, even since writing this the first time, it's getting more and more kind of in the news and, you know, it's a daily thing I know lots of people are thinking about is kind of how do you do good in a broken world, especially when you feel like you've kind of done some things to contribute to why things are the way they are. And every day you do a little bit more that you're not sure if it's actually pushing things in the right direction despite all your best intentions. And so there is a bit of a feeling that, well, I think when you open a fantasy book, a lot of people have a certain set of expectations and they think, you know, we're going to have our protagonist in a play, someone's going to deliver to them, you know, some either an item or a mission, you know, that and they're going to maybe ah about it for a few pages, and then they're going to be off. And then it's going to be them against the world. Where I feel like Fitch is kind of more like someone I associate with or that I see around me, dealing with the kind of internal struggles that I think us in our kind of modern world deal with. And so playing him off against the expectations of a fantasy world, and particularly this broken one, I think is continually interesting for me, and I get to ask a lot of questions through him that I ask when I'm, looking around at the world now and going, well, what do we do when these kind of people are in charge? And probably what we have to do to make a difference is a huge sweeping change of our lives that we go, is that worth it doing it individually? Do we have to try and how do we actually get up every day and do something that makes the world better for the people around you? For people as a whole, for yourself, and how possible is it today?
A word we haven't used yet is hard-boiled, but, I mean, Fetch is very much the hard-boiled. You can't say Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett without, and Bogey without thinking hard-boiled. So, I mean, a couple of really important questions when it comes to hard-boiled. The first one, we've talked about Fetch's reflection, his ability to self-reflect. And of course, you know, go back a century when those hard-boiled authors were writing, that sort of sense of personal psychology wasn't there. You didn't see Bogey sort of doing the recrimination as much as Fetch does. What did that bring to the character for you when you think about, say, the earlier influences?
Yeah, I do think there's... there was really intentional to go a bit deeper into that kind of archetype. And I think, I mean, one thing with the hard-boiled thing, I do think, especially in those Chandler novels, I think there is a real sense of romance there that often gets lost in the, when other people redo that hard-boiled idea and the homages happen, that they kind of take the surface level, you know, how, you know, Marlowe puts himself out to the world and often leave off that internal sense of romance that I think was always there inside. And so I really wanted to take that, but also then really examine, like, I think, you know, for me, a bit of why I love these characters, when I first, like, loved those kind of Bogart films and stuff was because, you know, I think when you're a teenager, we all really care what people think about us and can be so, like, you know, just struggle with that anxiety of, you know, are people judging me? Am I saying the right thing? And just wanting to get to a point where we don't care anymore. And seeing those kind of, like, just those... yeah, those movie stars or those characters that are just, that something terrible has happened to them and it's broken them. So they're like, I don't care anymore. Can they say the quippy lines and they can take the punches and dish it out? And like, that seemed really appealing to me as a teenager. Go, God, I can't wait till either my heart gets broken or something terrible happens so I can just be that cool. And, but then obviously, to get to that point, you know, to be broken in that way is nothing to be romanticized and generally means that's a probably very damaged person underneath who has cut themselves off from certain things and isn't a full human being anymore and isn't cut because, they've got trauma of some kind. And I think that's kind of going with Fetch, that he wants to present himself this way and he does successfully, you know, sometimes not so much, but actually to sit in and go, okay, for someone this jaded and cynical and broken, I think the more cynical someone is later on, the further you go back, the more romantic and idealistic they must have been earlier. And so playing with that balancing act.
But now we have the pieces in place on the board. We know a little bit about what the world looks like. I want to discuss what the novel tells us. Because two clear threads sort of ran through the action of The Last Mile in Sunder City for me. The Coda is this turning point in Sunder history. This is an establishing novel as much as it is anything else, because this is a new world. And in The Coda, we have humans. They're jealous of their mystical brethren. They shut down the source of all magic in the world. That's a really establishment point. How it happens is... read the book, dear listener. So it felt like, firstly, it felt to me kind of like the climatic catastrophe that we are constantly flirting with. You know, we've talked about how Australia's been on fire. Various parts of the world just seem to want to fall off because, as a species, we just are not taking responsibility for the impact that we cause. Was that in any way in your mind? Because, I mean, I just could not escape the Coda being something in our future.
Look, it wasn't the intention behind it. Like, it's hard to avoid it. And I think, as I kind of said before, my original ideas with it were much more about reflecting an internal, idea. But, of course, writing it now, it's you know, as I'm your second one's finished, and you know that we hope coming out hopefully sometime soon, getting onto the third, more and more it just is fuel for the fire as far as you know, right, what's happening in the world. Yeah, you, as I said, you can't escape and you can't separate it, and so yeah, which I do think, you know, those big questions are really being asked. And I think, and there's interesting where I think the first book has a little bit of like, you know, and I'm sure can sometimes frustrate some readers where you're going like, you feel like there's so much at stake still. Mm. Like, if this isn't in the aftermath or even the lead up, and, you know, you've got someone who's still kind of dragging themselves along, doing a little bit to maybe, you know, try and make things better, but this is huge stakes. Yeah, I guess it's only as we're talking about it, it's interesting because it feels like the difference, I guess, is that in this world there was a thing that happened. You know, we're kind of past that. And there are still people around and we don't know what it means. But people have had to make a shift. And so I guess one of the questions that happens in the book and continues on is like, there are certain people who want to hold on to, just want to go back. You know, and that's, and we really see that with one character in particular in the book of going like, I want to get back to what was. And because of that, you know, we see the effects of what happens there, as opposed to other people who are going like, no, like, that was great. Okay, things have changed, but I'm going to accept this change has happened and moved on. And I think that's where I see that most reflecting right now, because if we want to continue to have life on this planet, we've got to make some great shifts. And a little bit of an acceptance of like, okay, things are, like, already things are different now. And if we need to sacrifice a few things and change our way of life to make sure, you know, human life continues on this planet, then, yeah, we need to look forward and we need to change. But there is a huge movement around the world right now of people going, nope, you don't have to vote for us. I mean, you don't have to change anything. We're going to, that dreamy idea of a perfect world that you have in your head, we're either going to keep it or try and go back to it. And I just think, yeah, it, which is a ridiculous idea that usually leads to destruction because you can't, once things are moving forward, you can't fight it. So yes, that does influence the first book in some way.
Luke Arnold's Last Smile in Sunder City is the novel we are discussing. Luke, thank you so much for taking the time to come into 2SER.
Thanks so much for having me. Really great chat. Cheers, man.
Yes, this is 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. Now, my name is Andrew Papel, and look, it is almost time for me to say goodbye. So much so, I might even end up having to talk really quickly to fit it all in. Thank you so much to Luke Arnold and to Alison Evans, both of whom shared their fantastic new novels with us. If you want to hear more of those conversations, there are two new episodes of the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast coming up this week. If you subscribe, they will just appear in your podcast app and you can check them out. If you want to share this with other people, one great way is to give us a rating or just personally say, hey, listen to this, grab their phone and just subscribe them. My name is Andrew Popel. I have to say goodbye. It is just always a pleasure to be here with you. I will be back next week. There is still so much great Australian writing coming up. But until then, keep listening to 2SER, and from me, happy reading.